Take it from me. To be a stripper, all you need to have is no talent.
You'll pardon me, but to have no talent is not enough. What you need is an idea. Something that's gonna make your strip special.
Welcome back to Putting It Together, the podcast that explores Stephen Sondheim's entire body of work, show by show and song by song. My name is Kyle Marshall. I am the self-appointed fanatic of Stephen Sondheim. And today, I just realized that we are almost finished with our Gypsy season. This kind of really snuck up on me. And I don't know why, but this season seems to have gone by just so fast. We have this episode, we have Rose's turn next week, and then the week following we're going to be talking about the movie before we take a couple of weeks off. You know, sometimes I am going through my life and I realize that I. But that doesn't spell success, now does it? Listeners, I need to tell you, I sat here in silence thinking for 10 minutes of how to actually open up this episode. That's what I came up with. You're welcome, I suppose. All right, what else do I need to talk about? I always am committed to making this show the best that it possibly can be. I've been reaching out to some new people to be guests on the show, so hopefully those invitations pan out. I have been thrilled with the conversations we've been able to have over this last season, as well as West Side Story here earlier last year. But I'm putting out a survey. I did this at the end of West Side Story, and I'm going to do it again here now. There is a survey linked in the show notes to this episode that will take you roughly 5 minutes to complete. There's the first half that is kind of the required section to let me know about things that you liked, things that you didn't like about the show, and ways that we can make it better or things that you want to see continue on. And then the second half of the survey is completely optional. You can choose to do it if you want. It's just interesting information for me to know about. But if you could fill that out, I would be eternally grateful. All of your answers absolutely will be considered and make this show the greatest it can be. But here's a question for you. What's your gimmick? I think that in a way, I mean, this goes back to the idea that everybody wears a mask, no matter where you are in life. And this song really explores that. We've gotten to the point where Louise is now being talked to by a bunch of burlesque dancers and letting her know that in order to succeed in this business, you kind of need to have something that makes you unique, that makes you push out in front of the rest of the crowd. And I think that that is true anywhere you look at in life where you need to somehow stand out if you want to excel in what you're trying to do. In order to discuss that a little bit further, I invited on Eric Stadnick again. He jumped at the chance to talk about this song. I knew that I wanted to invite him back. I gave him a list of songs that were still available at the time, and he was like, gotta get a gimmick. That's the one. That is what I need to talk about. And I was excited because that was the exact opposite reaction I was getting from most other people, where they didn't want to talk about it. And in many ways, I kind of get it, right? I mean, it's this weird-ish song that happens right near the end of the show where a bunch of these older performers coming out and kind of showing Louise the ropes. It's not the most singable of songs, but I would argue it might be the funniest in the show. I also hope you have had the chance to listen to the bonus episode that I released a few days ago. Eric Matthew Richardson came back onto the show so we could discuss Co-op, the episode of Documentary Now where they skewered the original cast album of Company, that documentary that happened way back in the 70s. And I thought it turned out really well. It was a really fun conversation about a very funny thing, a very unique thing that exists now in the popular culture that I definitely enjoyed. I'm not quite sure how many other people in the world would even understand or get the references, but I think for us Sondheim people, it works. I love the fact that John Mulaney is so idiosyncratic that he chose to do a documentary parodying a documentary that most people have never even heard of. I also want to bring up something that I haven't talked about for a great long while, but as we continue to grow this show, and the show has been growing a lot over the last couple of months, if you could, in any platform that you're using, go and rate and review the show, I would be so eternally grateful. And if you know people who would love this show, could you tell them about it? Because again, I think that having every single person who would enjoy this program, listening to this program, helps out me, helps out you, and we can have a whole big love fest. I promise I won't bring any straight razors or serve pie. Anyway, before we go any further, I need to tell you that Putting It Together is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. They promote and support Alberta-made podcasts and connect their audiences with Alberta-based businesses and organizations. They also happen to be a sponsor this week, and so I'd love to highlight a specific show for you. So I need to tell you about That's a Thing. I've talked about this show before, but it's a sometimes belated, already outdated guide to your teens, tweens, and everything under 20. Elizabeth teensplains her media to her mom, Karen. So Karen, the mom who's getting things explained to her, has been on this show a couple of times. She also helps run the Alberta Podcast Network, is the head of the Alberta Podcast Network. And this is a show that I continually love when they release a new episode each month, mostly because I'm falling kind of in between the not understanding anything that Elizabeth is bringing up and also sometimes being like, oh, I know what she's actually referencing and talking about. I'm hip. I'm cool. For like a few moments, and then I realize, no, I am an old. What am I doing with my life? But then I back up slowly while doing jazz hands, and everything turns out all right. Anyway, you can find it and all the great shows at albertapodcastnetwork.com. We're also sponsored by ATB this week, specifically because I talk with a lot of creatives and artists on this show. I understand how difficult banking can be when you're pursuing that type of work. Working in the arts means income can be as varied as a time signature or a brushstroke. The ATB branch for arts and culture was built for artists so you can do your banking in a way that works for you and meeting other industry professionals. Creative and banking working together. It's why ATB will always be more than a bank. You can find more information by going to atb.com/thebranch. So thank you to all our sponsors. Take a look at the show notes for information about the music we're referencing and how to get your own book of Sondheim lyrics. Then we'll listen to the opening few bars from the original Broadway cast recording of You Gotta Get a Gimmick. On the other side of that is my conversation with Eric Stadnick. You wouldn't think there could be trumpets, but there are.
Grind your behind till you're banned. But you gotta get a gimmick if you want to get a hand. You can sacrifice your sacro working in the back row. Bump in a dump till you're dead. Kid, you gotta get
Eric Stadnick, thank you once again for coming back to Putting It Together.
Thank you so much, Kyle. I'm really happy to be back.
Just in case people did not hear your last episode, I think we should start by you describing who you are and what it is that you do.
Sure. So I'm an English teacher. I'm an American, but I live in Prague, in the Czech Republic now. I podcast and I blog about various things, and I'm a huge, huge Sondheim fan. Mm-hmm. And so actually, when you started doing this, another Alberta Canadian podcaster who I know through Doctor Who circles, which is one of my big things, mm-hmm. said, hey, you should talk to this guy. So that's how we met up for tonight, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think you're right. It is, actually, because I think I was going through old emails and I saw a page that I had taken a picture of that said tonight on it, if I'm not mistaken. So actually, even crazier than that, we have since become Facebook friends.
Yes.
And you posted something that you had, you know, uploaded onto Facebook a couple years ago, which was, when is someone going to make a song by song by Sondheim podcast? And look at that.
Yes.
Synergy has happened.
Yeah. No, I posted that and I, you know, forgot about it. It was a couple years ago. And then the little Facebook memories thing, which is sometimes helpful.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, remember this post? And I was like, I do remember this post. And so I shared it. And I was like, now you can listen. It's called Putting It Together.
I know. Exactly.
Yeah, it was one of those projects that always seemed a natural fit for podcasting for me, but I just never had the gumption to sort of do it myself. And so I'm very glad you're doing it instead.
Yeah, exactly. It's there's something to be said about being this frustrated when you go and search iTunes and like, really? No one has made this yet? And then you just like, fine, I'll do it. I'm narcissistic enough to believe I can do this.
Yeah. it's just a big commitment is the thing.
That's right. That's the thing. Yeah. I was sketching out ideas and like pre-planning here for this next year. I just wanted to know like what 2019 looked like. I thought like, I wonder what show I'll be getting into by the end of the year. And it's like, I won't be getting into company until December. I'm like, okay, That's not even halfway through Sondheim's output yet at this point. So
it's arguably where most people think he begins. He obviously he doesn't begin with Company. But yeah, the very tail end of the last episode I heard, which I don't know if there will be another one between now or then, the episode about Everything's Coming Up Roses.
Yes.
And you mentioned, like, you know, do I hear a waltz?
Yeah, boof.
That's going to be rough. That's going to be a rough one to find volunteers who want to be like, yeah, so let's talk about this show that everyone hates.
I have some ideas. There's some ideas that are percolating in my brain about how that one is actually going to work. It's going to be fun. When we get there, we'll get there.
Yeah, exactly.
This, I'm just trying to think actually in my brain. I don't know how time works, but I actually have committed to... Actually, no, this will have come out after the special bonus episode I'm going to make. I'm going to be making a bonus episode out of the Documentary Now episode of...
Oh, the co-op?
Yeah, co-op, which is talking
I've
about...
I've heard about it. Yeah. I haven't seen it.
Which it hasn't aired yet, technically, when we record this. It's airing in 4 days from when we're recording this episode. So there's someone who's volunteered to come on and talk about the episode and then the Company documentary that was made. And yeah, we'll make a short little bonus episode for people to listen to.
That Company, the actual D.A. Pennebaker documentary, is phenomenal. I hardly recommend
it. And it's on YouTube. You can literally go and watch it right now for free. Anyone can go and watch it.
Yeah.
So, not great quality, I will point out, but you can still watch it, the whole thing, on YouTube if you want.
Yeah. And it's not exactly like it's pristine camera work to begin with.
So I guess let's start here then. I mean, you have not been here for an episode of Gypsy yet. I'd love to know what your relationship is with this show.
So being I like musicals, but I'm more a Sondheim aficionado than I am of all musicals. Mm-hmm. And sort of my love for musicals largely grew from my appreciation for Sondheim. Gypsy was always viewed as something a little suspicious of Gypsy. Anything pre-Company essentially gets a little bit of shade.
Okay.
And certainly the shows that he didn't write the music for, like Gypsy, West Side, which has its own reputation, obviously. And then like things like Do I Hear Waltz get a little, you know, when you're a Sondheim person, you're like, oh, well, this was before he found his voice and all that sort of nonsense.
Sure.
Which maybe it's true, maybe it isn't. But and so it took me, I sort of knew a lot of the songs from Gypsy, as one does, because they're part of the popular culture. And so I didn't actually watch a full like version of Gypsy from start to finish until I watched the Imelda Staunton version, which is available to watch certain places online. And it was just blown away by how good the book was.
Oh, yeah.
Like, and it goes back to this idea that it's just a very well-written musical. I do not think it is perfect by any means. I'm inclined to agree with people who think some of the songs are just a bit bleh, and we get one too many scenes maybe of sort of, you know, Dainty June and her newsboys and all that sort of stuff. But, like, the characterization of Madame Rose, as Sondheim always calls her Madame Rose, not Mama Rose, which I think is quite interesting. But the characterization of Rose and June and Herbie and of course Louise, who becomes Gypsy, sort of really, it really was astounding that, you know, this was the late 1950s, that sort of in the age when Oscar Hammerstein was still doing his thing with Richard Rodgers, this was also happening at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost feels like from a completely different era. Yeah, so I was blown away by it. And then you kind of go back and watch other productions and see other versions. But it's essentially a showpiece for one lead actress. It is about who's playing Mama Rose, You know, it's about that. And everyone else gets slotted in. And I think that's part of the reason why I don't love it the way some people do. It feels too much like just a star vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel a lot of the other characters are underserved. But it's still a hell of a good show to watch. Like, it's... And it's much funnier than you think it's going to be, and just really well done.
Yeah. Do you have any, I mean, you know, you just said that Imelda Staunton was the first time you actually watched it from start to end, but is there any renditions that you like over the others?
Her version is astounding. I know this has been a sort of recurring theme you've been having, and I don't know if you've had a chance to watch her interpretation yet, but she is phenomenal in the role, sort of combining a lot of the elements that other people have sort of gotten praise for. Like, she has this sort of brassiness, but she also has a certain charm and seductiveness that other, like, you know, Bernadette Peters brings this sort of sexiness. You can kind of believe Imelda Staunton doing that as well in some of the ways she does things. I have never been the biggest fan of Patti LuPone, but I do think Mama Rose is a very good fit for her and her style and her voice. Mm-hmm. She is kind of our merman. And so that's nice. And I actually, one of the versions I watched that I enjoyed more than I thought I would was actually the Bette Midler TV version from 1993 or whatever it was.
I find that that's really hard to track down now, too. I can't seem to find any good places to actually watch the Bette Midler version from.
But no, it used to be available various places, and now it's sort of more, you know, shady. Mm-hmm. But when you get into theater, you're kind of used to watching shady stuff. Like, the number of productions of shows I've watched recorded on a cell phone behind someone's head is staggeringly high.
And, you know, you're not, yeah, early YouTube was great for that. I loved, like, well, this will be taken down in, like, a couple of weeks, so I'll just watch it now.
Yeah, and now you can rip things pretty easily off YouTube. Be like, oh, that's mine now. And so, as it was, you know, things just kind of spread. Now Tumblr is a big place for this kind of stuff to share.
Oh, true. Yeah, yeah. Well, okay, how about this song in particular? I know we were talking a little bit before you pushed record here, but we've gotten to the point of you got to get a gimmick, which is the burlesque dancers giving advice to Gypsy on how to be successful. So what is your first take on this song?
So you emailed me, you had lined up, you know, maybe half or a little bit more of the songs, and you emailed me like what was available. And literally, like, I had just woken up and I saw your email and I didn't want to miss the opportunity to do this song. And so I responded probably with many, many typos while I was still like lying in bed half awake. It's like, gotta get a gimmick because it's just fun. This show is so freighted with so much interpersonal drama and stuff like that, that even the songs that seem like they might be fun on their surface, like Together Wherever We Go, mm-hmm. has this sort of undercurrent of deception and lying and control and manipulation.
Yeah.
This, I think because Madame Rose is well off stage, no one else is around, it's just the burlesque dancers and the actress playing Gypsy. It's just fun. You could remove it from the show with very little damage to the dramaturgical structure of the whole thing. But it adds this wonderful bit of fun and life and charm and sort of paints the burlesque world, oddly enough, as a warmer environment than what Louise is used to. And so I think it's just great. It's just fun. It's just fun. And I think Sondheim is having a ball with the lyrics.
I think so, too. I think this is, you can start to see Sondheim having like the most fun with wordplay in this song. Because
mm-hmm.
I think in a different way, I mean, this probably has a lot to do with Arthur Lawrence writing the book as well, but you could have written this scene very differently with them being almost grotesque, right? And almost yeah. like, I don't know, like corrupting Louise into being in burlesque, but it's not that. It's them being like, yeah, if you're going to do this, then you have to think of something to like sell yourself properly. And it's just a fun thing to watch as an audience. It probably gets the most laughs, I would say, out of the audience during the night.
Oh, it's got to be. And it comes so late in the show. Like, there's a reprise of Small World, and then there's Louise doing Let Me Entertain You in her strip version. And then there's Rose's turn. Yeah. Like, you're essentially done by the time you hit You Gotta Get a Gimmick.
No, it's true.
It's so late in the show. And you talked on the Everything's Coming Up, Rose, about the sort of weird front-loading of the songs. And it's entirely true. And so at the point, this song, you kind of need something. I think.
Yeah, there needs to be that break in tension a little bit.
Yeah, you need something fun. And I think you need something to really illustrate why, even though she's kind of initially really terrified when she's pushed out there, we don't feel... Because if you did not have this song, and these characters were sort of more grotesque or more sort of vicious or vile or something... That scene where Louise gets pushed out by Madame Rose to, like, go, do, it would be even worse than it is. It would be unforgivable, right?
Yeah.
It'd be like, I'm sending my daughter out to strip. But we've seen these three women, proud, independent, strong women, singing about kind of, yeah, you could just be super naked. Like, but that's not what's going to do it. What you got to do it is you got to have an idea. You got to have a gimmick.
Right.
And so... And all these crazy gimmicks they're doing, which do not involve them getting neuter. You know? It's like, that's not what they do. It's instead, like, do this other thing to almost distract them from the fact that you're not naked.
Yeah, well, which is a little bit, I don't have actually a deep knowledge of burlesque, but my understanding is that that is essentially true. That there might have been some mm-hmm. nudity, but it was that was not the purpose of burlesque. It was the performance of it.
Yeah, and the modern burlesque now, which has the similar sort of vibe. It's a lot of like pasties and, you know, and sheer panties and things.
Right.
But yeah, it was more about sort of the titillation than the sort of graphic reveal. And there is that sort of, you know, they kind of use the terms burlesque and stripper interchangeably here, but there I think there is a distinction. And it's really, yeah, I think it's really just, it presents this world that we know she will end up inhabiting and conquering. You know, we know who Louise is going to be.
Yeah.
And anyone who saw this show would know who Gypsy Rose, I mean, she was still alive when they made this
Absolutely.
Show.
Absolutely. For many years afterwards as well.
Yeah, and for many years afterwards. So is June, by the way, but that's a whole other story. We have to feel like in some way, Louise is going to a good place. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think this song really helps that. It helps us feel like, oh, she will find success. She will find something resembling happiness, maybe, in this world, or love in a way that Rose could never give her. And so I think this song is crucial in making her sort of turn at the end not feel like a total degradation, no. Which I think it otherwise it could.
Well, let's talk about our titillations here then in this song. Because we have three characters who are singing here. We have the characters of Tessitura, Mazeppa, and Electra. So I just wanted to give credit where credit is due of some of the actresses that have portrayed this. Again, we're primarily looking at the original Broadway cast, the 2003 revival starring Bernadette Peters, and the 2008 revival starring Patti LuPone. So for Tessitura, we had Maria Karnilova in the original Broadway cast, and then Heather Lee from 2003, and in 2008 it was Allison Fraser. Mazeppa in the original cast was played by Faith Dane. In 2003, played by Kate Boudicke, and then in 2008, played by Lenora Nemetz. And then Electra, in the original Broadway cast, was played by Chauncey Foley, which is just a fantastic name. 2003 was Julie Halston, and in 2008, Marilyn Caskey. So those are the three characters that we have that are going to be singing here in this song. It's Mazeppa that starts, and she says, "You can pull all the stops out till they call the cops out. Grind, you're behind, till you're banned. But you gotta get a gimmick if you wanna get a hand. You can sacrifice your sacro, working in the back row, bump in a dump till you're dead. Kid, you gotta get a gimmick if you wanna get ahead.
You can pull all the stops out till they call the cops out. Grind, you're behind, till you're banned. But you gotta get a gimmick if you wanna get a hand."
I don't know. Is there any lyrics there that you want to call out right from the very beginning?
There's a couple, actually. The idea of both the words bump and grind being used the way we would think of, like, the bump and grind. I don't even know. And I tried to do some research on this, if you believe me, but I don't have, like, access to a massive OED. But bump and grind were both authentic burlesque terms from the early 20th century, but I don't know how widely they would have been known outside of that circle.
Right.
You know, I don't know whether the average theater goer would have been like, oh, I know what they mean when they say bump and they say grind. They would have gotten it from context clues, I'm sure. It's a really good example of Sondheim going into sort of the patois of a certain, you know, world. He's like in this burlesque world and he's like, I'm going to use their words. I'm not going to
make up
talk
something,
like someone from the outside or make up something, God forbid. He's like, I'm going to use their actual things. And so you have talk about grind your behind and bump in a dump. Of course, those internal rhymes are always delightful.
For sure.
And even the word gimmick was quite new at the time, comparatively speaking. So he's doing a lot of sort of like, and it would have been very, very new at the time that the show is set.
Yeah, I wonder how.
I just love that.
I'm curious, if this was widespread in all of theater or if he actually did go and do any type of research or just knew somebody he could go and talk to and ask these questions about. It's fascinating because I know, like, he mentions later on in his life that that's what he would do. He would go and try and write down words that would have been used in that time frame, in that era, and then try and use those into songs as well to make it more authentic sounding. So yeah, it's interesting. I have no idea on that. One call out I'll say at the very beginning, because it doesn't happen anywhere else in the song, but the very first two lines, he rhymes out with out.
Yes.
there must have been just like, he tried a bunch of different things, I have to think, and they're like, fine, we'll just start it this way, and then everywhere else I'll actually make two different words in the first two lines.
In his credit, yes, he does rhyme out with out, but it's actually rhyming all the stops out with call the cops out.
True enough, yeah. So
it's a four note, it's a four rhythm, four beat rhyme that he's doing. So I'll give him credit for
that. I'll give him credit because actually like stops and cops is rhymed as well. So I mean,
yeah, you can exactly, yeah. All and call and then the rhymes with itself. But yeah, yeah. It's sort of like it's almost the same sounds all the way through the line.
The second stanza though starts with you can sacrifice your sacro working in the back row. Do you know what a sacro is?
Yeah, so sacro is sort of like your sacrum, like your lower back essentially.
Yeah,
and it's a very sort of, I always think of it as being like New York slangy, and I did Google this as well, and yeah, I think it's sort of like New York sort of slang. He's really leaning into this sort of that. Mazeppa is a very forceful person, but maybe not the most educated woman in the world.
I think so, too. I mean, I never really heard that word before. Hmm. And because I was reading through these lyrics, I'm like, I have to look this up because I actually have no idea what this is. So you're right. It's the lower back. It's actually a part of the bone actually from the lower spine, but connected to the pelvis. So it's like an actual specific bone. This is what I found out. It is actually sometimes referred to as the holy bone because it's apparently so called either because the sacrum was the part of the animal offered in sacrifice or because of a belief that this is where a person's soul resides. This is according to, I think, Wikipedia, if I'm not mistaken, is where I brought that from. So basically saying...
Which is interesting that you can sacrifice...
Yeah, you're sacrificing your butt, right? That's basically what he's saying in kind of poetical terms.
But I love that sort of the sacrifice your sacro, the alliteration there. And he's really leaning into this sort of like, these are not proper women. And these are women who are speaking very differently than, you know, Rose does Herbie does.
Actually, what it really calls out, this is what makes me really appreciate Sondheim more and his attention to detail. There is a podcast that I've recently become really obsessed with. And everyone should listen to it. It's getting more and more popular. But it's called Punch Up the Jam. I don't know if you've heard of this podcast.
I haven't.
So what Punch Up the Jam is, it's these two hosts, and they invite on a different guest each week. And it's kind of like this podcast in that they're going through lyric by lyric of a specific song. So the guest brings on a song that they think is either bad or misinterpreted. And then at the end, one of the hosts actually makes a new song out of it, which I think is brilliant.
Interesting.
It's so great. Anyways, why I'm bringing this up is that one of the most recent episodes I listened to was their episode on Mbop from Hanson from the late 90s. And I mean, I was a preteen, I think, when that song actually hit really big. And of course, I have, I don't know, rose-tinted glasses listening to it because I still kind of enjoy it for just the musicality of it. But when you dive into the lyrics and you're like, what are they talking about? Like, it makes no sense, even the non-mbop lyrics. And what they called out is that they cram so many words into one lyric that it is like, that's why it sounds so mumbled at the beginning, is because they're trying to like cram like 15 words into something that only has like 8 beats. So they're like, like going through it like that. Yes, I'm ready. So when I come to hear it, Sondheim's like, and everything works so incredibly well together. Like, you can sacrifice your sacro working in the back row. Like, it just flows really well. And it almost feels like someone is speaking that instead of intentionally rhyming that as well.
Yeah, it never feels. And this is something he always calls himself out for when he thinks he's strayed. But here he doesn't, I don't think, which is he doesn't make the characters sound smarter than the characters would be.
Right.
He can be clever with the lyrics, but it still sounds authentic to the character.
I agree.
Yeah, and I think that's... And the fact that he does that with three slightly different voices in this song is very impressive.
Well, Mazeppa continues. Now, I will say, written in the actual lyrics, in Finishing the Hat, it says bump is what the lyric is. However, I think, but it's in parentheses. No one who is saying this has ever said bump. I'm fairly confident in saying. So they always like make some kind of guttural thing, or like there's some performance that's happening here at the same time. But you can. That's how burlesque was born. So I but I do it with a horn. And then she starts playing her trumpet, right?
That's how burlesque was born. So I but I do it with a horn.
And then, once I was a schlepper, now I miss Mazeppa with my revolution and dance. You gotta have a gimmick if you want to have a chance. Do you know what a schlepper is?
Yeah, to schlep. And schlep is very sort of...
That's a Jewish word, I think. Yiddish. Or a Yiddish word.
Yeah, I believe it's Yiddish. Yeah, to schlep, yeah. Which is a Jewish dialect, yeah. Mm-hmm. To schlep is just sort of like to carry something heavy. And so if you're a schlepper, you're sort of just like... It's like you're sort of like just a stupid doing the job. You're not really anybody special. You're just a schlepper, just some whatever.
Right, right.
You know, just schlepper. And of course, in her accent, though, schlepper becomes schleppa.
Yeah, that's right.
Which means he can rise it with Mazeppa.
That's right. So he can get away with it.
Yeah.
I was going to ask this question at the very end, but I think it's maybe more appropriate now, is that this song is very visual based. I think that there's a lot of things going on visually that you're supposed to, as an audience, like, take from it and laugh at. So do you think that any of the recordings of it are able to bring out the same, I don't know, comedy aspects of the song?
Not really. I mean, like, it relies heavily on a visual imagination, I think, if you don't know it. Once you've seen it even once, I think you can sort of supply mentally what would be happening.
Right.
But you do have, in most recordings, they leave in this sort of little musical interludes. You have Mazeppa with her horn, and then you have Elektra and Tessitura sort of little musical interludes where they're doing their burlesque strip thing also. Mm-hmm. And they're just hysterical. They're just a chance for the actress to sort of be completely silly.
That's right.
And have a bit of fun. But yeah, the ones where they cut those out, so you only have lyrics, don't really work the same way.
Yeah.
And I can imagine if you've never seen it, but you hear this song, you're sort of like, well, what's happening? Why am I...
What's going on? Yeah.
Why are they going on, and why are they including this? I think it does require that sort of visual element.
Well, Elektra is up next, and she says...
Oh, before we move on from Mazeppa, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know about the origin of Mazeppa?
I don't. Yeah, no, let me know.
Ah! Okay, so Mazeppa, who was in the original production, as you said, played by Faith Dane, and she does the... She also is the one in the movie, so if you've seen the movie version, that's her as well. She was an actual... These were all actual vaudeville performers, apparently, that they sort of auditioned to kind of have some, you know, versatility.
Right.
In the parts of the show.
In the original Broadway cast, you're talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, in the 50s, late 50s, they're putting the show together. They're auditioning a bunch of vaudeville people. And Faith Dane had been essentially a sort of like burlesque vaudeville performer, where she had this routine she did with a bugle that apparently had been given to her by someone, I forget who. James Jones, who wrote From Here to Eternity. And it was used by Montgomery Clift, supposedly, in the movie version of that novel. But anyway, she sort of, when she was putting her act together, she came up with a thing called a stripper in the whack, which was a sort of an American female auxiliary during World War II, drum and bugle corps. And it was essentially her, like, blowing her trumpet across stage as she, like, bumped and grinded. Mm-hmm. And so when she came into audition, she did that routine, and apparently... Everyone just lost their damn minds, including she did the thing where she bent between her legs and blew the trumpet.
Yeah.
And Sondheim was like, yep, that's in. So, like, the Mazeppa character essentially is the actress who played Mazeppa.
That's really cool.
Yeah, and there's a quote from Sondheim saying, in 1985, saying that the auditions were quite tedious, apparently, but it was all worth it for one thing. Faith Dane and her trumpet, that went right into the show.
I love that it's not like these people auditioned and you're like shocked and be like, I can't believe that they're doing this. It's like, no, that's going to be great theater.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of the dirty side of Stephen Sondheim, which I quite like.
Yeah, so Elektra is the next person to sing, and who knew that Gypsy was part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe? But here it is. So she can They'll never make her rich. Me, I but I do it with a switch. And so this is the part where, like, the lights go out and you actually see parts of her body illuminated, as you might imagine, of what's going on.
She can, she can, she can. They'll never make her rich. Me, but I do it with a switch.
I would also imagine this. Maybe this is just me being uncultured, but that must have been pretty extraordinary, I would have thought, in like 1950s theater as well, to do something with electricity or electrical stuff on stage, because it wouldn't be as easy as it is now to make that happen.
Yeah, you wouldn't have had LEDs. I quite imagine that, yeah, that it was quite a coup de théâtre, sort of like the lights dim on stage and parts of her body light up with these giant light bulbs or whatever they're doing.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't unheard of, but I think it would have been really, really funny and had a great effect. It still does, actually. I've seen recordings of people doing it live, and that moment always gets a big, big laugh.
That's right. I'm curious, too. Like the whole thrust of this song, obviously, is, like, you have to...
thrust.
You know, stand up... What's that? Oh, yes. Yes, that's right. I meant to do that. but the whole thing is that you have to, like, stand out from the crowd in order to do it. I'm curious, like, how long these characters, it took for them to figure all this stuff out. Is this something that they started with at the very beginning, or was it, like, I don't know, years upon years of iteration? I mean, the show isn't interested in answering that question, I know, but for me, I want to know how long it took them to figure this stuff out.
Yeah, that's actually true. I wonder what Mazeppa's shtick was before she thought of the trumpet.
Yeah, it was a harp. It was awful to try and carry across stage.
Should have double bass.
Double bass, yeah. So after her little interlude of showing off, she'll say, I'm electrifying and I'm not even trying. I never have to sweat to get paid. Because if you get a gimmick, gypsy girl, you've got it made. I like that idea. It's like, I don't have to sweat like these other people do. They're, you know, doing high kicks and dancing around the stage and being, like, really athletic. I'm just going to stand here and flick switches.
It's the laziest thing. I love it. Mm-hmm. It's she made this suit once and she has to keep the bulbs changed. But aside from that, she just kind of, like, stands around, walks around, shimmies a bit, does her and then she, like, electrifies various parts of her body so they light up.
That's right.
And that's, like, and then she's like, okay, done. And she calls me, you know, and she goes backstage. Is this the first time that Louise gets called Gypsy?
Yes. I think I even mentioned this in a previous episode where I couldn't think of any place where anyone calls her Gypsy. But this is like the one song that she is. Absolutely 100%. She's called Gypsy by name. It's a mishearing of what her name actually is.
But she's just met Elektra and Mazeppa, so...
Yeah, so sure. They're calling her Gypsy even though that's not actually her name. But that's what she's going to take as her stage name. Any cool backstory on how Elektra's came about in the show?
Not that I know of. My guess was that Sondheim and Lawrence had already sort of planned, if they had even had this number in mind, which maybe they hadn't had this exact number, they'd always figured we'll make up some whatever.
Right.
But then Faith Dane came in and was like, okay, well, she's in, and then get two other things. Mm-hmm. Notice it's interesting. Like, Elektra gets the least. She only has her two little bits.
Yeah.
She gets very little at the beginning. She doesn't get much at the end either. She's sort of just in there. The only thing that we know about her is that she's clearly the youngest of the three, or she feels the youngest of the three.
Yeah. Maybe that's, yeah, she's innovative. She's doing the innovative approach to
yes. Burlesque. She's using modern technology.
Tessie is next, and she goes, all them and them ain't gonna spell success. Me, but I do it with finesse. And then that's her, yeah, like kind of dancing around the stage. Yeah.
Yeah.
All them us and them us and them us ain't gonna spell success. Me, I but I do it with finesse.
again, another visual type of gag that you kind of have to see to actually pick up on. Dressy Tessitura is so much more demure than all them other ladies because you got to get a gimmick if you want to get applause. I like how she, how Sondheim rhymes Tessitura with demure.
Oh, it's so great. It's so much more demure.
Yeah.
Because it is an actual thing that like poor speakers of English will do is they'll be like, he's more smarter than I am.
That's right. That's right.
Like, it's completely authentic. But she knows the word demure because she knows the word finesse. She likes using these sort of like fancy sounding words because she was a ballerina.
That's right.
She's like, yeah, Tessitura is so much more demure. It's great. I love it.
It just works so well. Mm-hmm. And then they all kind of get together and they do a little bit of like a round. Is that the right term?
Yeah.
Where one starts and then the other one starts after. But they all are supposed to be saying, do something special, anything that's special, earn you a big fat cigar. You're more than just a mimic. When you get a gimmick, take a look how different we are.
Do something special, anything that's special, earn you a big fat cigar. Anything that's special,
so special and freshal, that's the rhyme that we get for the first two. But I do like mimic gimmick. I think that works really well. How do you like this section? Because I think this is the only section that's a little bit different than the rest of the other song, where they're kind of all talking and singing over top of one another.
See, to me, this is super duper Sondheim-y.
Yes, it is.
Where he, and I don't, you know, who knows what Julie Stein gave him exactly, whatever he pulled out from his trunk or something.
Yeah.
Probably was, you know, that's how Julie Stein worked. But Sondheim here decides to do like a little trio chase round thing going on, which he does again in Follies. He does again in some versions of Into the Woods, like this idea of having the three people who've all had their own turn and they all have done different things and you smush them together at the end.
Yeah, which...
It's a technique he likes.
Which I personally love, but it also causes you to have to really... I don't think there's any way that an audience member would pick up on everything that's being sung the first time you watch it. I think you get
the impression
of what's going on, but when there's sometimes different lyrics and different inflections going on, it's something that you have to either listen to or watch a few times to be like, oh, that's really cool why everyone is singing that way, and then taking that interpretation out of it.
Yeah, the most extreme example I can think of is he does it in Opening Doors in Merrily We Roll Along, which you'll get to in 5 or 6 years.
Right.
Where like he has this long section where four different people are all singing different lyrics for quite a lengthy period of time. And they're all great lyrics. And they're all like fantastic within themselves, but they're all just clashing. And so you don't hear any of them. But I think he likes the idea of using different lyrics or different time with the same lyrics to sort of create a sort of cacophonous sort of, like, at this point, we're all sort of Louise. She's just sort of overcome by the sheer, in her mind, it's kind of magical. Like, she loves this little song they're doing for her. She always claps and looks so happy at the end. It's like the first time she's ever enjoyed entertainment almost or something. It's very odd.
Right. Oh, this is what it's supposed to be like. Oh, this is fun.
Yeah, I think it is. Honestly, I think it's the moment where she's like, oh, I could enjoy this. This doesn't have to be being the butt end of a cow or...
Right.
You know, being the center of an act that's not any good with all these Hollywood blondes around me or whatever.
So the end part of the song is probably my favorite because, I don't know, I just like the rhythm of it, and I think it ends with a really good joke.
Mm-hmm.
So they all kind of stop there. They're singing over top of one another, and then Elektra says, if you want to make it, twinkle while you shake it. Tessie says, if you want to grind it, wait till you've refined it. And then Mazeppa goes, if you want to bump it with a trumpet, which is always my favorite line.
So good.
And then they all come together, get yourself a gimmick, and you, too, can be a star.
If you want to make it, twinkle while you shake it. If you want to grind it, wait till you've refined it.
If you want to bump it with a trumpet.
So get yourself a gimmick.
I do want to call out, because Sondheim has a little asterisk beside one of the lyrics here, which is Elektra's, if you want to make it, twinkle while you shake it. He says that there was a different line originally, and he was forced to change it from Jerome Robbins. He said he wanted it to be, shake it till you break it. But Jerry wanted him to draw attention to the costume that they were wearing. So the compromise was twinkle while you shake it instead of shake it till you break it.
I think that's actually probably arguably better, because the other two sort of couplets both go with the persona, the stripper personas.
Mm-hmm.
So like Tessie Turner says, wait till you've refined it.
Yes.
She's very refined. And then Mezuppa has the great closing joke with Bump It with Trumpet. So it's nice that hers does reflect the fact that her shtick is this, you know, her gimmick is this sort of twinkle costume.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's really lovely, like that final line, and you too can be a star. It feels like it's not rhyming, but it is. It's rhyming all the way back with, take a look how different we are.
It's true. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you've had to wait like a couple sets of lines. But because it's so far separated, it just feels... it feels like it comes out of nowhere almost. And it's sort of like this big word, star. Like, you will be a star. Like, ooh.
That's right.
It has this sort of greater impact, especially the way it's phrased. Yeah. But no, it's just a fun way to end a silly little dance song.
It's fine. It may not be the one that I like to listen to off of any of the soundtracks the most, but man, is it one of my favorite things to watch when the show is on. I did actually eventually get to see the Imelda Staunton version. I actually watched it off Broadway HD, and it's great there too. It's really fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's super fun, and you can cast. It's great just watching all the different versions, because you don't... I won't say that the women can't sing, but you don't even need women, actually. Like, this could be drag queens.
Oh, yeah.
This could be old women, young women. It doesn't... it's just like, get personalities.
Get people who
will sell it.
Yeah, you need someone. Yeah, you need someone that can actually inhabit that role. It doesn't really matter anything else. Here's my question that arises from this. This entire song is about getting a gimmick. So, What is Gypsy's gimmick eventually?
Gypsy's gimmick is that she's too good for it. Gypsy's gimmick is that she's aloof and she's removed. You know, we see the bit at the end that's interspersed with her adult version of Let Me Entertain You, when she's talking about having dinner with the Henry Fords and, you know, her French lessons and ecdysiast or whatever the word is.
That's right.
About, you know, a stripper. She's like, but at these prices, I'm an ecdysiast. Mm-hmm. Like, that's her gimmick. Like, it starts with the sort of like taking a glove off and being very... and then she kind of realizes it's like, I can just sort of really, really want them. They'll really want to see me do something. And sort of if I do it just right, I can kind of just like tease and tease and tease. And especially if I sort of have this attitude of being like a very intelligent, educated society woman, anything they see will be amazing.
Yeah, it's almost like, I don't know, like early stand-up a little bit, because because it's really just using words and like using punchlines and stuff like that. The only extant version or example of her actually doing her striptease is actually a part of a film, which I've now forgotten the name of. But I actually found it on YouTube. It's the only time that it was filmed. And it's a lot of like rhyming couplets that she uses, and then it's usually like set up punchline as she like removes, like you say, like a glove and then throws it into the audience, or removes like a very small piece of clothing and throws it into the audience. Now my understanding is that it was a little bit more risque on stage than what the film version is, but
yeah, I'm sure
it's basically the same thing that she was doing in front of crowds. So it was more like her using words instead of actually doing any type of like routine or anything like that.
Have you the faintest idea about the private life of an exotic dancer? Well, up until a few years ago, it was New York's second largest industry. Now, a fan dancer's education requires years of concentration. And for the sake of explanation, take a look at me. I began at the age of 3, learning ballet at the Royal Imperial School in Moscow. Oh, I suffered and suffered for my art. Then, of course, Sweet Briar. Oh, dear college days. And after 4 years of psychology, zoology, biology, and anthropology, my education was complete. And I was ready to make my professional debut for the Minsky's on 14th Street.
Yeah, and she had... Yeah, because she was like part of Ziegfeld Follies, like booked her, and she was at Minsky's, like she was in huge shows she was doing.
Yeah, yeah.
To sell out houses on Broadway, making tons and tons of money, making sweet, sweet cheddar. to the point where there's a song in Pal Joey, which is a Rodgers and Hart musical, about a reporter interviewing Gypsy Rose Lee.
Right.
And the entire song essentially is a parody of her act, and it's called Zip. And the idea is that she would say all these very smart things, and then zip, a part of her costume would come off,
yes,
or whatever.
Yes.
And she's saying things like, you know, I was reading Schopenhauer last night, and I think that Schopenhauer was right. And just all this, and that it really gets a sense of that's how she was seen. She decided, okay, I don't have talent. I don't really have this. I don't have that. What I can do, though, is act super duper smart, and that'll make the guys even hotter to, like, see a finger.
Yeah, I guess it goes back. It does tie into the rest of the show. I mean, this is a common even movie trope, but she's shown reading books earlier on the show, which mm-hmm. means that she is super smart, right? but I think it is true. Like, she, I think, was probably fairly well-read. That's what she liked to do in her off time while she was, you know, in the back of a cow, as we keep referring to it. That's what she valued. She liked her book, she liked reading, she liked learning new things, so she probably did know all this stuff that she was bringing up in her act, and so she just spouted off, make her seem like more prim and proper, and then taking off like a single glove is so much more effective, because it's like mm-hmm. oh, this seems even naughtier, because this is a high class woman instead of the normal one we see when we come here.
Exactly. She made it's funny, I almost feel like she took Tessitura as like the idea of being refined. Like that idea stuck in her head.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously this is all fictional, but like in the context of the show, it feels like the one of these three who sort of had the most impact on her was Tessitura. Although I think that when we see the strip later, there's elements of Mazeppa's sort of I'm not taking any guff from anybody sort of vibe also.
One final thing I wanted to end off on, and I don't know how much you'll align with me on this one. There's only one other place that I know of that uses the term gimmick in this same way. And this is mostly because I grew up, and to be perfectly frank, still am a fan of professional wrestling. So, and really, if you look at the history of professional wrestling, like this started off in like circuses and like carny life and stuff like that. How do we trick this audience basically into thinking that this thing is real and to give us their money because they're all a bunch of dopes? And that grew into like what it is today, but still kind of the same thing. This is the theatrical performances that's happening, and the way that we make this mean something, or the way that we make this have the people react in some way, is that there has to be these defined gimmicks of people. That's literally what they call them in the wrestling business. So, I mean, back in the 80s, it was easy. You just had to have a Russian versus like the All-American. That was basically the two gimmicks.
Yeah.
You have to be a little bit more nuanced, I think, in today's age, but that's the thing. So I think this still is true to a certain extent. In order to get over or to become someone that fans or people want to watch, you have to get a gimmick that people like. And then after that, it's easy because you're that gimmick for the rest of your life.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I've heard it on and off throughout my entire life, but I don't often, in the sense of like someone saying you got to have a gimmick, which feels like they're just quoting this song.
Yeah.
Because I think this phrase of got to get a gimmick or got to have a gimmick entered the lexicon almost as much as Everything's Coming Up Roses has.
Sure.
Because gimmick was an early 20th century word. No one knows the origin of it. It seems to originally come from like stage magicians, and may actually be some sort of weird manipulation of the word magic to get the word gimmick.
Oh,
no one's quite sure. It just kind of pops up.
Sure.
So it would have been, again, fairly newish at the time of the show, and very, very new at the time it's used in the show. And so I don't know how much this song had to do with popularizing it. They won't remember your name, but they'll be like, oh, that's the one that does that thing. Like, oh yeah, that's the one with the swords, or that's the one that does this. Yeah, your gimmick.
So I guess final question then to you, Eric, is this. Mm-hmm. If you had to start a burlesque show, what would your gimmick be?
My gimmick would probably be, I think it would probably be a male version of Gypsy Rose Lee's sort of vibe. But instead of like coming out in like an evening wear, I would add in my love for Jane Austen. So I'd come out like dressed like Mr. Darcy.
Yeah, sure.
And like waistcoat and all that. And because I think, you know, as the Pride and Prejudice miniseries with Colin Firth proved, even getting him in his, like, undershirt and pants diving into a lake sends women, you know, in a tizzy. And many, many men, for that matter.
Sure.
So I think that's probably the lane I would go down.
Nice. I like it.
Yeah.
I envision that mine would be a little bit more in tune with Electra's, where I could just get some, like, hue lights set up onto some sort of, like, switchboard or something like that and do something, I don't know, innovative and stuff like that.
And you could, like, swipe on yourself and do all sorts of stuff. Yeah.
Clap on, clap like off, you know? Well, thanks again, Eric, for coming and joining me here and chatting a little bit about this song. If people wanted to stay in contact or see what you're up to, how could they do that?
The simplest way is to just follow me on Twitter, which is at SJC Austenite. That's AUSTENITE. You can find all the other stuff I do there, podcasts and blogging and whatnot. That's by far the best way because everything else kind of gets scattered to the four winds.
Okay, good to know. Thank you once again.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Well, now I think you know what I need for my birthday, an entire outfit made of LED lights. So get on it, people. That was a great conversation. Thank you to the Alberta Podcast Network and to ATB this week. Next time, we're going to be talking about Rose's Turn. So we're coming to that ultimate episode that everyone has been waiting for. It's going to be really, really good. If you have additional feedback, comments, questions, or a great guest idea, please send those to puttingittogetherpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you to Terrence for being one of our Playbill level patrons. Also, a big thank you to the always great Chris Taniguchi, who designed the podcast artwork, and to Nick Driscoll for composing our theme music. For now, though, we've reached the end of our episode. Yes, I know. Goodbye for now.
It's hysterical. Like, when you look for the lyrics, it says it's being sung. Google thinks it was sung by Bette Midler.
Yeah, exactly. One of them thought it was Freddie Mercury when I searched for him. Like, that's not true.
What? That's crazy.
Yeah. So, the earth is flat, everyone, because I can believe everything I read on the internet.